Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is day 13 of our coverage of the 2016 Iditarod over on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley, radiofreepalmer.org. You can hear all of our episodes over on iTunes as well as on social media. Just search for Dog Works Radio. Again tonight, you find me in a parking lot here in the beautiful city of Wasilla. It's snowing a little bit here, which is rather common in March, but we haven't seen snow all winter, so it's very interesting to see how El Nino grabs you by the feet and turns you around and puts you the other way. So looking forward to a little snow this weekend, possibly running some dogs in the spring weather. Looking forward to that. And on the line calling in from California, I do not know if he is in a supermarket parking lot tonight. I did not ask him. Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great. I'm actually calling in from my kitchen tonight, which is much better in terms of the Wi-Fi coverage.
Very good. You know, we were talking late last night about who was going to be in at the time we went on air. And I have to say, are we good or what? We said 50 or 51 mushers will have crossed under the arch by the time we go on to air. And it looks like number 51, Alan Eichens, I believe is how you pronounce his name. It looks like he'll probably go under the arch while we're on the air or shortly thereafter. That's some pretty good predicting on our part.
Yes. You know, we've talked a lot this year about the trail being very, very fast. A lot of people getting in earlier than we would have thought. To have 50 racers in on Thursday night is an enormous accomplishment. We've also, I think, seen a lot of teams that have traditionally done very, very well have not done as well this year. A lot of teams who maybe we didn't peg as top 10 or top 20 finishers managed to get in there. So it's been a very interesting and in certain ways unpredictable Iditarod, even though we haven't seen any of the massive cold snaps that we've seen in the past few years. We haven't seen any massive storms. It's been pretty consistent, but yet also unpredictable.
Right. And since we were on the air last night, right before we aired last night's show, our musher profile was on Jason Campo. He was the last one in when we went on air. Since then, Tor Albrightson, I believe is how you say it, Martin Booser, Karin Hendrickson, Christy and Anna Barrington, who I believe came in together. That is appropriate since they are the Barrington twins. Justin Savedis, Cody Strath, who is a rookie, Paige Dronby, Didi Genro, and Nathan Schroeder. I know we spent a good amount of time last night talking about Nathan, and he finally got his dogs to go and was healthy enough to pull on through. I guess he and Didi sort of ran that last 25 miles or so together. So that's definitely a good deal for Nathan. We're proud that he was able to pull it together. I know he was pretty ill yesterday because of that. He was able to do that today. Jody Bailey, Monica Zappa, Mike Williams Jr., Melissa Stewart, James Volek, and it looks like Alan will be in shortly. And then shortly after that will be Tim Pappas, I believe is how you say his last name. So, again, about, 20-odd mushers came in the last 24 hours. We still have, about 20 left
22,
out on the trail. Is that right?
23? Yeah.
22, 23 mushers on the trail. 21. So let's quickly talk about the two scratches before we get into tonight's topic. Earlier today, Billy Snodgrass scratched. He is an Iditarod veteran. He scratched in Unicolete. He is from Wyoming, and he scratched for the health and concern of his dogs, which is, usually the common response. We want to make sure that these guys are taking well care of their teams, and it looks like they are when they say that. And then Ellen Halverson, she was withdrawn. We've talked a lot about this over the last few years, about the infamous Rule 36 rule, where the race marshal makes a decision to pull the plug on a musher, and they did so on Ellen Halverson, also in Unicollegiate, and at the time she only had 9 dogs. I just saw the press release just a couple of minutes before we went on air. Do you have any more on either Ellen or Billy from what you were reading through the day, or no?
Yeah, well, you know, Ellen had been lagging behind pretty much the entire race. She's the only person in the history of Iditarod to have won the Red Lantern more than once. She won it twice and was, was not ridiculously far behind, but was always trailing the back of the Packers. It's always a bit of a difficult decision to make whether someone is considered still competitive. I think that in this case, probably because she was not traveling with anybody else, that it was just her, that it was ruled that she was no longer competitive and that she was, you know, part of the reason that they do this is there's a limited number of volunteers to staff the checkpoints, and they, leapfrog up and down the trail in order to make sure that all the checkpoints are staffed. So if there's someone who's running considerably behind, it's a logistical problem to keep the checkpoints staffed when they're coming up to them. So my guess is that's why she was drawn. I had been hoping last night that she would, you know, start to make a little bit more progress and take perhaps not need to take rests that were as long, so that she could still be running with some of the other back of the Packers, you know, like Mary Helwig. And in my experience, it usually seems like unless they are very, very far behind, if there's 2 or 3 mushers, they're less likely to be withdrawn than if there's just 1 straggler.
And you know what else, Alex? Typically when this happens, you usually hear some backlash from the mushers when this happens. You know, over the last few years, not only in the Iditarod, but in the Yukon Quest, these guys obviously are not very happy about having the race called off for them. And you'll typically hear a statement or two because of that. And because of the new rule, I guess they're calling it the gag rule, I don't think we're going to hear any backlash from Ellen or if anybody else has this rule imposed on them. What do you think about that? Do you think that that's a good thing, a bad thing? How do you feel about this this gag order when it's sort of for this particular reason?
I would rather it not be in place, just because one of the things I like about Iditarod is people are generally a little bit less polished and filtered than in some of the larger sports. But I imagine that if someone has something to say, they'll figure out a way to say it, or they'll wait the 45 days to say it. We've seen in the past when mushers have been withdrawn from the race for being uncompetitive, some of them have actually continued up the trail, and they're not continuing officially. They're no longer part of the race. They're no longer supported in the same way. But the Iditarod Trail is a trail that anyone can go on. So if they want to, they could continue up the trail and continue to Nome. And that's happened a couple of times. There was a case in the 1980s where Colonel Norman Vaughn was withdrawn for being uncompetitive, and he just decided that he was going to keep going, and he finally reached Nome 6 days after the official Red Lantern winner and 4 days after the winner, which was Susan Butcher that year, had won the race. So that is not an unheard of thing. But, you know, it's always I'm of two minds because I, on the one hand, I'd like to see anyone who can keep going be allowed to keep going, just because I know how much this race means to a lot of people. So I don't like to see them taken off the trail before they're ready to go off the trail. But I do understand that, you know, in terms of logistics, it's very, very difficult to keep the race going when you're juggling checkpoints that are hundreds of miles apart. So I'm actually sad for Ellen because I think in a kind of warped way, it would be very interesting to have someone who had run, who had won the Red Lantern three times.
And, you know, a very little-known rule in Iditarod, if you make it to Uniclete, that counts as an Iditarod qualifier. And for people that don't know, you have to have two races of over 300 miles and then one race of another mileage, whether it's a 200 or a 150 or if there's a 175 out there or whatever. Technically, it will count as one of these qualifiers for folks that make it to Uniclete, whether they scratch or are withdrawn or whatever. Now, this only comes into play, I would assume, if they were to do something that we talked about several days ago, where we're talking about people having to re-qualify or look better for the qualification board. I find it interesting that they count this 700-plus miles on the trail as a 300 quote-unquote qualifier. You know, I know they count the Kobuk 440 as a qualifier as well, but it would seem to me that it's sort of a moot point. If you're already qualified and you make it to Uniclete, even as a rookie, you don't need to have the qualifier anyway. Does that make sense, Alex?
It does, and it does seem like they are, if they're introducing that they would be setting it up for having people requalify.
Yeah, and that rule has been in place for quite a few years, if I remember. I remember when it was brought to my attention several years ago from folks that were forced to scratch, or not forced, but you know they had to scratch for whatever reason, way down the trail at Uniclete or even further, that it would count as a quote-unquote qualifying race. So just a point to ponder. I guess we could delve into that after the race season. Maybe it's a good topic for another show. As folks know, we do a biweekly show, Alex and I, in the off season. We started that last year after Iditarod, and I hope to continue doing that as well. So, Alex, we want to talk about two stories that came across over the last 24 hours or so. The first one is about Martin Bucer. And we've talked about Martin and his son Nikolai quite a bit during our race coverage this year. For folks that just happened to be tuning in, his son Nikolai was in a very serious car accident in Seattle a couple of months before Iditarod. And Martin and his wife flew down to be at his bedside. He was in ICU for quite a while. He's currently in rehabilitation. And just yesterday or the day before, he's doing visits out in the public. They took him to the grocery store. And, you know, he's still trying to relearn all of the things that he sort of lost while he was in a really bad car accident there. But he did survive and is doing very well. But when Martin pulled in earlier today, or at least since we've been on the air, one of the first things he was quoted as saying is, he is here just so he can catch a plane to Seattle. So what do you have to say about that, Alex? And then we want to talk a little bit about his very gruesome-looking picture that he posted on Facebook.
Yeah, Martin has had a difficult race this year, and I think not unexpectedly because of what happened to his son. It's hard to imagine that even though he is a great dog musher and someone who has so much experience that he could probably perform better half asleep or three quarters not there than most people could when they're totally focused. But his concentration was clearly not as much on Iditarod this year as it has been in the past. And, you know, that's not to fault him. I think anyone would be like that. And, you know, a lot of people are just amazed that he even was able to run Iditarod at all. So, you know, he was doing fairly well early in the race. Early in the race, we had the situation where there were a number of past Iditarod champions, including Lance Mackey and Jeff King and John Baker, who were all right up at the front, and almost all of them ran into problems and then fell back significantly. So a rough race for Martin this year, but under the circumstances, I think I'm just glad that he made it all the way to Nome. And I think he's probably glad that he made it to Nome as well, even if he's just going to view it as a stop on his way to the airport.
Right. And I saw something on Facebook. I guess he has, 30 total finishes, and 30 every time he's finished. He's never had to scratch. I believe he has the longest consecutive streak of anyone that has ever ran Iditarod with that number of times on the trail. So yeah, he is one heck of a musher, but yeah, he has to, you know, he has to have his mind elsewhere, I can imagine. And, you know, I can only think about my own kids, and, you know, I'm a nervous wreck when my daughter doesn't come home, you know, for after the movies with her boyfriend. So I can only imagine where his thoughts were, you know, all of this time when he was out on the trail, because as you know, there is relatively no contact in many of these villages. He can get quick updates here and there, but he's not getting phone calls from home. Those are deemed illegal and deemed outside assistance. So he cannot talk to his wife and say, how are things, you know, in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to commend him. I'm sure he's on his way to see his son, if not now, in the very near future. But what about that picture? I know a couple of days ago there were some postings on Iditarod.com as well as his Facebook page where he had a pretty nasty fall, pretty nasty injury, but they didn't talk a whole lot about it. They called it gut-wrenching injury, or he passed out or something from the fall. But you really saw the picture in all its glory today, didn't you?
Yeah. And, you know, it is not unusual for people to fall on the trail, for people to get banged up a little bit. This is just part of what happens. But he posted a picture that showed both of his legs, and I believe it's his right leg, was completely blue and purple. And it was, interestingly, not swollen, but it just was so discolored that it must have been just a gigantic, gigantic fall.
Right. And of course, keeping with the sense of humor, the caption on the photo was, "How do you like your steak?" And he said, "I prefer medium rare." And, yeah. You know, it really looked it looked pretty nasty there. But I guess if you've been on the trail for, you know, nine plus days, your humor is, you know, a little odd compared to how it may be. Because he's usually kind of a straight-laced guy, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, he does definitely have a sort of wry sense of humor. And not to overgeneralize, but it's I believe he's originally Swiss. A lot of Swiss people and German people have that kind of dry sense of humor where you might think that they are always serious, and then they say something and you just think, wait, that was really funny. How could that be coming from you? So,
right.
So, you know, I think he definitely does have that side to him. It probably just doesn't come out a whole lot, or it doesn't come out a whole lot in public.
Right. All right. So let's move on to our second story. It sort of broke shortly after we went off the air last night I remember pulling into to home and, you know, loading up the computer to load up the show, and I saw the press release and statement from Allie Zirkle. She was about, 24-odd hours after she pulled into Nome, and she made an official statement based on the events that took place on, I guess it was Friday night, early Saturday morning with the snow machiner. I don't have the statement here to read to you, but you can find it on Iditarod.com and pretty much all over the place if you just search for it on Google or any other social media site. What do you have to say about that? I found it rather interesting in what she said and, you know, how she sort of put things and how she ended it. What are your thoughts? And I'll say mine, I guess.
Well, among other things, she talked about how she's been mushing for over 20 years and that she's never felt that she was in danger from another musher or another human being, and that she's had to share the trails with other mushers, with snow machiners, with people using the trails for various purposes, and that she had never before felt that she or her dogs were at risk until what happened earlier this week. She said in the statement that that she felt like she was a hostage and that she felt like her life and the lives of her dogs were in danger, and that this went on for several hours. She went on to thank the race officials, the veterinarians, the villagers from Nulato, and the fans for being extremely understanding and supportive. She thanked the state trooper who took her statement. She said that she is very, very angry with this one person. And she said one of the things she likes best about running dogs and running the Iditarod was being able to interact with all of the people at these villages across the state. She talked a little bit about her dog, her dog Clyde, who was injured, treated by the veterinarians there, and now I believe has been or shortly will be reunited with the team in Nome. And she said that she is very sad and angry about what happened, and that even though she has not made a complete statement to the public about what happened, that she did give her statement to the police, and she said that her faith in humanity has not been destroyed, but that this was an extremely upsetting and distressing event, and that she doesn't want to make any further public statements about it. So I think first of all,
what are your thoughts on that?
I think first of all, it's an amazing statement, and I cannot imagine how completely frightening and terrifying this must have been for her. It was very clear interviews that she did after this happened, even though she didn't want to talk about it, she was very she was visibly shaken and was very upset. I think some of us in the Iditarod fan community have come to have this expectation that we deserve a lot of things, that we deserve to know everything. And we were talking about this the other day with regard to scratching and people making statements about why they scratched. I don't think that we deserve anything more than what she gave us. I don't know if she's going to make a more detailed statement about it in the future. This is, you know, when she said that, it was when she had been off the trail for just about a day or a little over a day. She may, over the next weeks or months, decide that she has something more that she wants to say about it. And if she does, I would certainly love to hear what she has to say. But if she doesn't, I think we need to respect that and not pressed for her to give us more, because I don't think that is something that she needs to do.
Right. And you know, my thoughts are pretty much exactly in line with what you said. And I just want to quote real quick from the press release. I'm reading it from Iditarod.com. It says, quote, "Those close to me know the full story, as does the Alaska State Trooper to whom I gave my statement. The events of the night were extremely distressing to me, and I do not wish to make any further public statement on this matter." And I agree exactly, end quote there, I agree exactly with what you said. I know a lot of folks want to know the whole story. You know, it's sort of that I want it now mentality, and how we've gotten so accustomed to it. You know, people are getting all of their news now, not from the nightly newscast anymore at 11 o'clock. They're getting it from Twitter and Facebook and social media. That's where we're getting our journalistic insights these days. And a lot of times it's not even from journalists. It's from citizen journalists and passerbyers and overhearers and all of that. And I think that's a wrong way to go about news in today's world. I know it's a fact of how things are happening. But on the other hand, Alex, as you know very clearly, Allie Zirkle and her husband Alan are very fan-friendly. They maintain an excellent social media presence. They've done it for years. They have a whole crew of folks that update several times a day on social media of what's happening. And, you know, they'll say the afternoon report on the black team, or, you know, the overnight report on the red team, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a very stark contrast from that. This is, you know, this is, it sounded raw. It sounded real. It sounded, you know, I have to say something because it's necessary, but I don't want to go into details. And when I first read it, Alex, what I was thinking about is when we talked about the gag order just a few minutes ago, and then on a previous show, how all of these mushers are not polished PR people. You know, they're human, they're raw, they say what's on their mind. Sometimes it even gets them into trouble if they say something that's sort of out of place. And knowing Allie from how she has interacted in the past, and she was on our show a couple of years ago, one of the most enlightening interviews we've ever had on Mushing Radio, this just shows just how visceral this experience was. If you can kind of empathize with that, I guess. It just showed that raw emotion out there of just how terrorizing it was, and, you know, what is to come. You know, it's very interesting to see how this sort of plays out. If we ever hear about it, it might just, you know, sort of dwindle back to the back page, as they say in newspaper terminology. And, you know, it might just be a story that kind of just filters itself away, and we might not ever hear the true story. But I'm okay with it, and I believe you are as well. Any other comments on this situation? Obviously, I don't want to look at this from an armchair type fan base. I'm looking at it more from, you know, how people convey information in today's society. And I think that that's what happened today or yesterday with her statement to, I'm not sure who exactly she gave it to first. I assume it was to Iditarod.
Yeah. It would, expecting this or holding my breath, it would not surprise me if at some point in the future Allie does feel like she is able to and wants to make some sort of additional statement about this. But as you said, this is something that is so fresh and so very upsetting that I think it's probably a good thing that she is taking the time to process this, to really deal with it in a way that, in a private way. I don't think this is something that needs to be a public process for her.
Right.
And like you, I'm aware of exactly how public and how fan friendly both Allie and Alan are. So for her to say no, not this, is is something that is very different from the normal day-to-day way that she operates in the world. And frankly, it should be, because this is not a normal thing, and this is something that is very terrifying and should not be taken lightly. So I admire that she was able to put out this statement. I think it really says a lot about who she is as a person and who she is as a musher. I have said for years that Ali Zirkle is one of the best ambassadors for the sport that is, because of her professionalism, because of her dog care, but mostly because of her joy about what she does and wanting to spread the word about that and get people to know the mushing lifestyle better. So, obviously this is still a very raw and very tough thing. I'm not sure that we ever will really have a clear idea of what happened that night or why, but as far as I'm concerned, if Ali Zirkle doesn't want to talk about it, that's fine.
All right, Alex, since we are now recording, we got to make sure we do our nightly duty here and talk about our musher profile. I know last night we ended the show without one to mention. Who are we talking about this evening?
So this evening we're talking about Sarah Stokey. And Sarah is kennel mates with, I guess that's the term, with Run to Kennel with Travis Beals. She is a young, up-and-coming musher. The two of them are just a very compelling couple. Another one of these small kennels that's fielding two teams in the Iditarod this year. She graduated from Falmouth Academy in Massachusetts on the tip of Cape Cod in 2006. And she says that the way that she became attracted to mushing was she was homesick when she was about 7 years old, and her parents had rented the movie Iron Will, which is a movie from the 90s about dog racing. And she watched it and she thought, this is great. This is what I want to do. So from then on, she started reading all of the books that she could about dog racing and the Iditarod, following the Iditarod. And every year for her birthday and for Christmas, she would ask her parents to buy her a dog team, which they were able to resist doing for a very long time, partly because she lived in Massachusetts and there wasn't really a lot of terrain that was friendly for mushing. She then started corresponding through email with Susan Butcher and became email buddies with Susan Butcher and asked Susan for advice for how to become a dog musher, and they were emailing back and forth. And then Sarah said, well, how should I go about putting a kennel together? And she's, you know, at this point, she is a kid. She's maybe 10 or 12 years old. And Susan Butcher was giving her advice, and finally she said, do you have any dogs that you could sell me? And then they went back and forth, and there were a couple of older dogs that Susan was going to sell her. And then they had agreed on the price, and this was going to require all of the money that little Sarah had in the world to do this. And then her her mom went on her email account, as she did from time to time, to just monitor what was going on with her online, and saw this and put the stop to that and said, there will be no Susan Butcher dogs coming to Massachusetts right now. She said that when she was in fourth grade, her aunt took her on a 2-day overnight mushing camping trip, and that was the first time that she was really involved with dog sledding up close, completely fell in love with it, and decided that that's what she wanted to do. So she went to Northeastern University, majored in sociology, but during her last couple of years, every weekend during the winter, she was driving up to Maine to do volunteer work at a kennel. And she worked extra hard during the summers so she could graduate one semester early and then spent what would have been the spring semester of her senior year doing some dog mushing in Western Massachusetts with Lev Schwartz, who went on to run Iditarod in 2014 and 2015. She, after she graduated, she moved to Seward, met Travis Beals the next year. On their first date, he took her dog mushing. He had about 20 dogs at that point. He took her out on a sled, and one of the dogs that she had in lead on that sled was one of the dogs who's one of her main leaders in the Iditarod this year. When he completed his first Iditarod in 2013, she was in Nome for the finish, and he had arranged with his father to fly up a ring for him. So when he got to the Burled Arch after finishing his first Iditarod, he proposed to her, and she said yes, so they are engaged now. She was scheduled to run Iditarod last year, but withdrew before the race because of the general lack of snow and a lack of training time on the snow. Last winter, in search of snow to run on, they drove over 20,000 miles with their dogs looking to find some place where they could run. The dogs that she has now, that she and Travis has now, she's raised most of the dogs that are running with her this year since they were puppies. She said that her goal for this year was to finish in 11 days, and it looks like she will finish in under 12. She said she wanted to finish in the top half, so it looks like that won't quite happen. But nonetheless, she's running a team of younger dogs with a couple of veterans, doing extremely well. She and Travis do glacier tours in the off season down in Seward, and she said that she really wants this to be something that she's going to do every year, that this isn't just a one and done Iditarod, that she wants to keep coming back, keep doing better and better, and really developing their kennel into a first grade kennel. She said about Travis that he's like that teacher that you have that you kind of hate when he's your teacher because he's very nitpicky, but then afterwards you think about all of the things that you've learned and say, oh my God, that was the best teacher I've ever had. And she blogs a lot on her website, which is turningheadskennel.com, talks a lot about training issues, things like getting ready for the food drops, just really keeps track of what the entire lifestyle is like for their kennel. So a lot of great stuff over at turningheadskennel.com for both Sarah and Travis. And, you know, as we talked about a while ago, it's really great that there are these relatively smaller kennels that are fielding more than one team. And, you know, I have to think that these up-and-coming mushers, these up-and-coming kennels, are really going to contribute a lot to the future of Iditarod.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, as we were talking earlier, there are several of these couples on the trail there this year. And I know that the Alaska Dispatch News ran an article, I guess it was yesterday, maybe the day before, about finding love under the arch or something like that. And they had a picture of Allie and Alan, you know, giving each other a smooch there under the arch. And you know, mushing is a very close-quartered sport, so to speak. And a lot of times you will find, you know, romances are made on the trail, and, you know, marriages happen between couples. We talked about it last night, you know, with the Doherty family being a family affair, with his mm-hmm. wife wanting to run Iditarod, and the kids and everybody is all on board. So mushing is definitely either an all-in, or, as we've mentioned on the show as well, you know, I think we put a quote from one of the guys that we talked about, where he had a very respectful wife, or something to that nature, where she is accommodating, I believe is what we said, with the wife being on board for the husband to go out and run on these grand adventures.
Right. And, you know, we talked about, we talked a little bit a few days ago about Cody Strath and Paige Drobny, who also have one of these kennels, and they finished 42nd and 43rd today. It looks like for Sarah and Travis, they briefly were in the same place. They were in McGrath when he was, I believe, finishing his 24 and about to leave, and was there for a couple of hours when she came in. So they got to at least see each other on the trail, even if they didn't get, you know, because of how he's doing. He was finished number 11 last year, this year a little bit further back, but still in the top 20. You know, so he is running a race very much at the front of the pack, where she's much closer to the back of the pack.
Right, and
but
this,
still,
this is very
it's
common.
Her rookie year.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's her rookie year, and she's really doing great.
Right, and this is very common, as we've talked about it many times with Allie and Alan. One of the couple obviously will get the A team, or, you know, the superstars, so to speak, and the other one will get the puppy team or the younger dogs, or vice versa. And I believe that's how it's set up with both Alan and Allie, and also with Sarah and Travis. But with Cody and Paige, I think it's a little bit more of a level playing field. You know, they did very well together, very well middle of the pack. I think that they had a little bit different strategy together. You know, they were running to both do very well versus the other two couples that are, you know, trying to push one person forward and the other person sort of take more of a back seat, so to speak, and train the puppies or the younger dogs.
Right. And, you know, Sarah said, it was an interview she did with the Insider at one of the checkpoints, and she said that she's taking rests that are a little bit longer than what she had thought, but it's what her team needs. And so it's important to be able to, when you have a puppy team or a younger team, it's really important to be able to give them a really great experience out on the trail. And then some of them will rise and maybe become part of the A team. Some of them won't, but maybe can, you know, be a very solid B team dog. So you want to make sure that they have really great experiences when they're going to Nome, so that next year they start on the trail and they're like, oh, great, we're doing this again.
Right. All right, Alex, since we are well overdue here, tomorrow's show, which will be day 14, Friday night show, three more left in our coverage of Iditarod. Who are we talking about in the next couple of days?
Okay, so we're going to, I am looking for exactly how to pronounce his name, but we're going to talk about Noah, is it Pereira?
I don't know. We'll have to look that up before we air for sure.
I believe that's how his name is pronounced. He is out of White Mountain. So on his way, should be in Nome by the time we're on the air tomorrow. As a rookie, he's currently in 55th place, and we'll be talking about him tomorrow night.
And then on Saturday, another very interesting pronunciation of a name, another rookie Miriam, how do you say this one?
I would guess Oscar.
I believe it's how you say it. Yeah. Man, we're terrible, Alex. We're going to talk about Noah and Miriam on the next couple of shows. And I know in news, and not saying that we're reporters by any stretch of the imagination, but that's a big faux pas when you don't know how to say the folks' names in your story. So we'll make sure for folks that are listening that we'll have appropriate pronunciations of their names. But, you know, people have been mispronouncing my name since I was in kindergarten, so I sort of know how it feels.
There you go. Yeah. So, yeah, I get that too, although, you know, there's kind of only two ways you can pronounce my name, so.
Very good. Well, Alex, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We have a couple of more days here. We're looking forward to entertaining you for at least through Sunday, so looking forward to that. Alex, take care, and we'll talk tomorrow, okay?
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host today, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We'll see you guys tomorrow night for Day 14 coverage of the Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. Make sure you check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Dog Works Radio in the search bar. Make sure you leave a comment, a question, or even a concern, and we'll make sure we address it. And if we need to make a correction, we'll do that as well. Talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.